Okay, first question today. Simple. How do you push back on FDA when you don't agree?
Well, I'll start that one. I think when you push back first, you always try the conversation, right? So can I have a nice conversation? And I always come from that. How can I help my reviewer say yes? So how can I position that so that that's what they want to say? So I start there. Sometimes that doesn't work. The next thing I would do is when I get an AI letter or a request, a deficiency letter, is I take advantage of that 10-day meeting and make sure, right, I'm asking the questions. What did you really mean by this? So I can get to the heart of the issue. I have done submission issue request meetings. Sometimes those are necessary when you don't necessarily agree on where the deficiencies came from or what they're asking for. The least burdensome flag is one of the newest ways, only since 2019 when that guidance came out. Not a lot of people have used that yet, but it's a new option for people to consider. You can file an appeal, and that's a more formal process, and you're going to submit and you're going to hopefully get a good answer at the end. In a case where we missed the timeline for the appeal, we issued a request for reconsideration, and FDA took that into account. And the other option is you can always go to the ombudsman, particularly if you don't know which of those other options you should do. The ombudsman's really helpful in helping you navigate those waters of appeals and least burdensome flags and things like that.
And when you're thinking of when or how to push back, I think it ultimately ties back to these least burdensome principles that FDA abides by. And essentially, it says that FDA should only be requesting information that is absolutely necessary in making your SE decision or your safety and effectiveness determination. So if you feel that the request is not least burdensome, or that you're being held to an inappropriate standard, then you should definitely not be afraid to push back in those cases.
And I think, if you are pushing back on the FDA, I think that a lot of times companies may be hesitant to do so because they are afraid of burning bridges or, souring a relationship with their reviewer. So I think, one thing to keep in mind is in order to help maintain that good relationship with your review team, whoever your FDA reviewer is, to exhaust your options kind of one, option at a time. I think, as Nancy mentioned, there's a lot of different things you can do. So if you take them one step at a time, start with first, if you don't understand something or you disagree, maybe start just having a conversation with your reviewer and, try and involve the team and, keep going from there, because I think that helps maintain trust with your reviewer and they won't feel like you're, going over their head, so to speak.
Yeah, that's good advice. So, where did that phrase least burdensome come from? Like, what does it actually mean?
Yeah, so the phrase least burdensome was added to the Food, Drug, and Cosmetic Act in 1997. And it was used within the act in the context of using the most efficient means of getting a file, a marketing application to completion, essentially. The actual definition, how FDA interprets the act, it's evolved a little bit over the years by way of guidance, but in the 2019 least burdensome guidance, FDA now defines it as, I'm quoting here, the minimum amount of information necessary to adequately address a relevant regulatory question or issue through the most efficient manner at the right time. So FDA realized that was kind of a loaded definition. So within that 2019 guidance, they have seven what they call guiding principles to help stakeholders understand what FDA thinks about when they interpret that definition. From a reviewer standpoint, I think how I always thought of it was making sure I was asking for just the information that I needed to get to an SE or to an approvable or whatever the file type. And trying as best as you could to hold companies to the same review standard within the same device type.
I would like to highlight on that seven guiding principles that least burdensome is a two-way street. So one of those sevens is that it's also a like not a requirement, but it's also an ask from the companies that they're providing materials to FDA in a least burdensome manner. So that means it's well laid out, it's clear and concise, right? And not just like a giant data dump for FDA. So while there is least burdensome principles that FDA abides by, there's also an ask on the sponsors to be providing materials in a least burdensome way as well.
Yeah,
So does
that's
FDA
a really
hate
good
to
point.
hear? Go ahead, Brian.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, I was just going to say, I think that's a really good point that Kevin made, because I think, you know, if you can help the FDA, you know, present things in a clear manner and help them, you know, help walk them through, you know, the argument you're trying to present or whatever data you have, I think that can be really helpful, and it helps save them time, and, you know, it helps them focus on, you know, what are the important issues or the important, you know, testing areas that you're, you know, device has, or what are the important risks. So it can help them focus on, you know, the important aspects of your submission or whatever you're trying to accomplish.
Right. So I think a majority of questions probably stem from misunderstanding or miscommunication or something. If you're giving FDA something not laid out and they ask you a question, you're like, oh, we explained this though. I don't get why FDA is still confused. Why are they asking this question? It's definitely not least burdensome, but FDA's not even, you know, didn't fully get it from your submission. So I think how you present information in your submission can even get ahead of addressing some of these issues that would be flagged or appealed.
And yeah. Like, sorry, go ahead, Nancy.
Yeah, I think sometimes on the company side, right, you've spent hours debating certain features of your device. And so you made those design decisions to basically avoid a certain adverse event or something that maybe a competitor device does have as a flaw. Mm-hmm. But if you don't tell the reviewer, right, that you made this design change for this reason and it negates the potential for this to occur, then they have no reason not to believe that this wouldn't have the same problems as some other device that's on the market. So I think it's really easy to forget how much time went in up front in designing that device to make sure it was robust. And then you forget to convey that information of how you got to that design feature and why it is different or unique than what else is out there.
Does FDA hate to hear the words least burdensome, or is it okay?
It's all about the presentation. So there were a number of times where I would just hear the term, almost like the regulatory affairs person was on autopilot, and this was just kind of their stock response whenever they get a deficiency. You know, we think it's least burdensome, and expecting it to go away, just saying those magic words. But mm-hmm. if it's described within the context of why the company thinks they're being held to a different review standard, maybe highlighting by going through different 510K summaries, if you're talking about 510K land, showing how FDA has historically reviewed a certain device and kind of presenting that to the reviewer, because really a reviewer can't, you know, sometimes there are hundreds or thousands of devices that a reviewer could look at. You can't look at all of them within the review cycle. So if you, as the company, can highlight sort of the review history, obviously FDA should know how they've evolved over the years, but if it's a long history, if it's a huge and complex device type, you can sort of lay that out for FDA, help them understand why you think it is a different review standard.
Right. Yeah, I think, you know, I don't want to speak for Ryan or Brian, but I feel like I heard it a lot. And then you see it. Absolutely. It's written everywhere. It's a very common vernacular. If you see it in any appeals, any pushback, you see it, and you don't just see least burdensome applied to questions asked. You might sometimes see least burdensome of how the reviewers interacted with the sponsors, right? Like they could have interacted with us in a least burdensome way, maybe compiled the questions a little better or asked it a little bit faster or something. And I think, like what Brian was saying, if you see that, if you see the least burdensome, but it's like supported, and it actually is one of the requirements of throwing the flag, is that when you throw the least burdensome flag, you need to propose a pathway forward. And I think when it's combined and not just like a complaint against the agency about, oh, least burdensome, check, then I don't think it's too bad. Especially, or maybe I'm just so beaten down by hearing it over the years that I've just gotten accustomed to it.
Yeah, no, I think I agree. I think it's only irritating, I suppose, to an FDA reviewer if there's no kind of explanation or if there's no, you know, good rationale behind it. You know, the FDA reviewers, there's a lot of least burdensome training, and it's kind of, you know, always, you know, hammered in and reinforced that it's a really important concept. So I think it can be really, you know, it can be well received if you present a solution with it. You know, I think like one example could be, you know, the least burdensome concept, it, you know, explains that it's looking for the right information at the right time. And I think that right time piece of it can be really difficult to answer. So, you know, maybe if FDA is asking for a test that you don't really think is necessary, or maybe you don't think is necessary yet, you know, you could, if you propose a solution, like maybe a different kind of test can mitigate that same risk, or, you know, maybe if you're trying to do an IDE submission or start a clinical trial, maybe you could implement some additional monitoring to help mitigate the risk, depending on what it is. Because I think if you approach it as kind of a, you know, trying to work together with the FDA and say, hey, you know, we want to help everyone be least burdensome and get the right information, I think that can go a long way.
Sorry to kind of add to Ryan's. I think FDA has been very proactive with adopting alternative methods with submissions of how to review data of alternate sources, right? Like that whole pre-post-market balance. Is there a shift that we can don't have to ask in the pre-market that we maybe can collect in the post-market space to address this, maybe like conditions of approval or other ways? I think FDA has released a lot of guidance documents that kind of tie back to this issue of like how let's work together to try to figure out a more creative solution, maybe than traditional path to get this through. And just to clarify, the least burdensome flag or these least burdensome principles don't change the evidentiary standard of submissions. Even though FDA is maybe evaluating other methods to get you through the line, like over the line itself has not changed.
So Kevin and Brian, you've been out of FDA long enough now to do submissions on this side of the house. Do you actually write the words least burdensome? I bet you haven't done it, have you?
That's funny. So we did have a recent submission where we were getting a lot of pushback on a draft guidance, and people were implementing this draft guidance before the finalization. Even though we knew it was coming, they were pushing back on these requirements that were, they were trying to enforce these requirements that have not yet been finalized. And it's, and we did not say least burdensome, like, hey, you're asking this, but I think we were able to push back in kind of a more professional way to say, hey, you know, these requirements haven't really been enforced. We've had other submissions go through this. We've seen other competitors go through this. And I think it's a nicer way to say it. And we were able to actually resolve this in a 10-day call. But if we appealed it or threw the least burdensome flag, then I would almost guarantee we probably would throw that language in there.
So Nancy, you've been doing submissions for more years than I'll name on here. Have you used the phrase in your communication with FDA?
I have used it once in a pre-submission meeting, and I will tell you, I did not go to the meeting with the intent of using that language. We were having really good discussion. We had lots of topics where we had to negotiate, but it wasn't, right? We weren't really fighting too much. It was more, how can we resolve this? And we were willing to do additional testing and things like that. Meeting was going, we got through the first two. We got to the third issue, which we thought was going to be a slam dunk. We left it to the end because we thought we could address it in like 30 seconds. And the subject matter expert on the FDA side dug in her heels so deep, like there was no conversation. There was no trying to get at, why do you need this? Why isn't this alternative provide the same safety level for the patient? And it was just, this is what we want and this is what we need. And, you know, the medical reviewer tried to ask some questions, they got shot down. The director tried to ask some questions, they got shot down, all by this subject matter expert. And it became really obvious in about 10 minutes in that this topic was not going to be resolved in the meeting. And I did use the phrase, is this the least burdensome approach to solve this issue? And the room got entirely silent. The phone lines went dead. And I had this pit growing in my stomach like, oh no, what did I just do? Because this is not going to go well. But actually the director spoke up and said, let us take this offline, address it internally at FDA, and we'll get back to you. Now, I will say it was a tense couple of weeks waiting because it literally meant a year delay in the product getting to commercialization if we had to redo this testing in the way that this one subject matter expert wanted. We submitted the meeting minutes. The meeting minutes came back with a note that they had met internally, agreed to the compromise that we had proposed in the meeting. And it worked out, but I will say I would still hesitate to use it, But I think in that case, it was probably the appropriate because it did get the attention of the leadership in the room and they did take ownership of it. Yep. So
that sounds like an informal flag throwing.
Yeah.
It's example, interesting.
Yeah. That example sounds like a perfect situation where you probably would have thrown, you could have thrown the flag if you needed it. Mm-hmm. I guess it also highlights that what you guys were saying earlier, there's like a process of going through this before you push back and formally throw a flag, where you should having these conversations with FDA either through the den day call or submission issue meetings. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of what we saw in the pilot as well, where there's only out of like 135, I think, or something, there were only two flags that were thrown, which means a lot of the issues were able to be resolved interactively before officially throwing that flag.
That's good.
And I think Nancy's example also highlighted, so yes, you would throw the least burdensome flag first, but if you have a subject matter expert or anybody on the review team who's kind of, you kind of get the sense that they're railroading you a little bit, like sort of maybe guiding you in a direction that isn't from a regulatory perspective appropriate. I mean, one of the beauties, so to speak, of an appeal is that you're getting a direct line of communication with the one over management. So if you have a meeting in an appeal, you know, you can have the meeting with the one over management and the review team, but the review team should be kind of off to the side. It should be that one-to-one communication with the one over and the company. So it's because sometimes FDA reviewers, subject matter experts can get passionate. And sometimes it's the appeal meetings can help just kind of focus on, okay, what are the regulatory requirements here?
It's funny with this seasoned regulatory group, how we all kind of nervous laugh when we talk about saying the words. So it really shows how kind of misunderstood and uncomfortable the words make people. Okay, so to FDA, what's the difference between the least burdensome flag with the new process and an appeal?
Yeah, so I think there are, you know, there's definitely some process differences and differences in requirements about, you know, what you have to submit for each. But, you know, I think when the least burdensome flag was first kind of being rolled out and tested a couple years ago, you know, the FDA had a public webinar. And during that, the way they kind of described the difference was, the least burdensome flag is more about the fundamentals of the deficiency, whereas they see an appeal being a deep dive into the administrative record. So I think, you know, the way I kind of look at that is the least burdensome flag, it's good if you, you know, aren't sure why FDA might be asking about something. You maybe disagree about the need for a certain request. Whereas an appeal is, you know, it's looking into the deep dive of the administrative record. So I see an appeal being better for a situation, you know, it's used for situations where, you know, maybe the whole review of your submission has been completed. If there's some kind of difference in opinion about how results are interpreted, you know, maybe if clinical trial results, you know, you disagree with how FDA ultimately interpreted them, that sort of thing, an appeal would probably be the way to go. But that was kind of how FDA described it publicly. And obviously there's more nuances to how each one's done, but I think from a high level, that's a big difference.
Yeah, I think Ryan added, like, summarized it perfectly, but just wanted to add one thing, that the least burdensome flag currently is only for 510K related issues. So if you have a PMA or de novo, you won't be able to throw your least burdensome flag during your interactive. If that changes in the future, maybe, but yeah, I just want to highlight that when we talk about least burdensome flag, it's primarily for 510K related issues.
Right. And so those cases, maybe an appeal is a little more appropriate, and also for final decisions. So if you have an NSC letter, you don't have that flag anymore. So an appeal in that case would be the route that you might need to take.
Yeah. It's also, if you're going to throw that flag or you're going to file that appeal, is you better have your facts right first, right? So if there's 15 510Ks cleared under a product code and every single one of them did the same test and you're arguing it's not necessary, you know, you have to decide whether that's worth the delay in the project to fight that versus, gosh, there's 15 and only one other one ever did that test. You know, I think you have a better case and a more compelling argument for the least burdensome path.
I would also say, so for the least burdensome flag, our group was part of the pilot, so I left before it's finalized. So based on my opinion, though, I mean, and my, I guess my experience so far is that the severity of an appeal seems to be greater than that a least burdensome flag. Because a least burdensome flag is still like an informal review based on your division management, versus the appeals will go to your office management, and you can still appeal those like different layers. And when you bring anything up to like the super office now, it's a lot, right? There's a lot of people get involved, and you really need to make sure that everyone has to have all their ducks in a row, both FDA and the sponsors, because it's getting reviewed on a much higher level.
Should a manufacturer be wary of using the least burdensome flag process or appealing in general? Like, does that kind of brand them with the scarlet letter at FDA?
I wouldn't say so. Like Ryan mentioned earlier, FDA staff is very well trained on least burdensome principles. And I think, you know, you spend, I see the concern where you spend all this time building a relationship with the reviewers. Mm-hmm. And now you're pushing back and saying, hey, I disagree with you to a point that I want to bring it to your management, right? And who likes having mm-hmm. people speak to their managers about an issue? But I think you can address it in a professional way, right? You can throw a flag or throw an appeal without being a jerk. You can like preface it with your reviewer saying, hey, I think there's still some discussion to be had about this issue, giving you a heads up that I think we're going to raise this one level just so we can resolve this, because there's still some unanswered questions. And if you really feel that maybe there's, some maybe potential issues for bad blood, or maybe some issues that like you would want to bring someone else involved. Like Nancy was saying, you could bring in the ombudsman, who's a neutral third party, to kind of arbitrate that situation to make sure that nothing is, mm-hmm. you know, nothing be held against you. If you really feel like potentially that, you know, you upset your reviewer or something.
Exactly. I mean, I think a lot of it is, and we've talked about this, is about the chain of command. So if you get something from a reviewer that you don't like, the first thing you do should not be to pick up your phone and call the commissioner. There should be going through the chain of not that the commissioner would pick up the phone for you, but starting at the reviewer, team lead, division director. I mean, the reviewer appreciates keeping it at their level as much as possible, and then sort of escalating it gently, so to speak. I guess I'd also say to not use appealing as a threat. This happened to me a few times as a reviewer. Just, you know, you could tell that the company isn't being receptive to the feedback that you're getting for them, giving to them. It'll cost more time. Cost more money, take more time, and so forth. And occasionally they'll throw the, well, we might end up appealing this, like before even exercising those other options. So it's, you know, we've talked a lot of in these chats about, you know, maintaining a cordial and professional relationship with FDA, and this is just sort of a continued take on that.
Yeah, I think it just kind of, you know, emphasizes the idea of, you know, trying to maintain a good relationship with your reviewer and your review team. I think, you know, if you discuss with them ahead of time and you try to, you know, tell them that you might have to appeal or throw a flag, you know, I think giving them at least a heads up, you know, really helps to soften that blow. You know, I think when I was a reviewer, I had a couple times where, you know, we would send feedback to a company, you know, asking them to do something, and they disagreed with it or, you know, didn't feel like they were able to do it. But, you know, we tried to go through, look at alternatives, see what we could do. But the company, you know, might say, you know, we have no choice. We kind of have to, you know, get another opinion on it. And, you know, that's what I would understand, you know, if you explain yourself and explain, you know, what you're going to do ahead of time. I think that can really, it's not going to get you branded as, you know, troublesome or anything if you kind of explain, you know, your need and what you're doing.
Right. And I think That's it good. Is another tool that FDA has, because I think one of the biggest issues that we always face in FDA now on the consulting side, we kind of see too, is there's a lot of variability depending on who your reviewer is. Right. So some reviewers might have a different opinion than others. And I think if you, by raising it up to the management, like higher level chain, hopefully that person who's overseeing multiple files over multiple areas provides a more consistent review practice, I think. So there's issues about or concerns about this is being unfairly applied or unequitably applied, I guess, across groups or across teams or something. That could be another kind of check and balance of making sure that any reviewers, any variability in reviewer practices are kind of evened out.
Can a reviewer handle a least burdensome flag on their own? Could they resolve it?
No, so in the guidance, it tells you it's gonna go up into management, and so there'll be an internal meeting at FDA, and then the response to the least burdensome flag will come back on behalf of the director for that group in CDRH.
Okay, it's a tough question.
Yeah,
go ahead.
In general too, like if it's something where you know, your lead reviewer maybe could resolve it themselves, then it's probably, you wouldn't even want to, you know, go through the hassle of throwing the flag. You'd probably want to, you know, see if, you know, you could have a call with them and try and work it out, sort of informally, or more informally, I suppose. I think if it's something where just one person could resolve it, it might not be appropriate to throw the flag.
Okay. So the hardest question for today, how do you balance the timing of, like, you know, you have the go through all the proper steps before appealing or throwing the flag, but you have other time restrictions to keep in mind. How do you do that?
So I would say the trickiest part, I guess, is if you're throwing the least burdensome flag. I guess the only time you can throw the least burdensome flag is when you receive the AI letter for a 510K. Mm-hmm. So now you're tied to 180-day timeline. The least burdensome flag has a 60-day timeline where you're supposed to throw it before, like within those 60 days, right? But it also requires that you interact with FDA at least once before you throw this flag. And they don't specify what kind of interaction, but there's multiple times, like Nancy mentioned in earlier in this presentation, that you could have an informal communication with the division management. You have a 10-day call. And I guess the trickiest one that would actually push the timelines is maybe a submission issue review meetings. So if you file those early enough, it's only a 21-day clock. But if you wait too long, then their clock becomes 75 days and you miss that submission, and you miss that flag throwing window, right? So I guess to balance it, if you see your deficiency letter, read it. And if you notice anything that's kind of setting off those flags in your head, like, oh, this is a very unreasonable question, act on it first. I guess try to have those 10-day calls to see if you can clarify it. And I think the balancing act is, like, do you move to the submission issue meeting or not? And I guess deciding between just having a submission issue or going straight to the flag, I guess it's going to be the part where some discretion comes on from the sponsor's part of deciding, is this, like, what is the level of this issue? Does it rise to the concern? Do I think we can address in a submission issue meeting, or do we want to throw that flag? But in terms of timing, they're both within this AI window that you have to act relatively quick to make sure that if you get your communication in and you have time to still throw that flag.
And I think if you're in the situation where you have that submission issue request queue sub within the open review window, I think from the industry side, you need to make sure that your project team is agile and ready to respond to FDA requests, you know, because you only have until that 180-day deadline. And if you need to do new testing, if you need to retool some usability analysis, your team needs to be ready to adjust and execute those quickly.
Right. And like Brian said, you only have that 180 days. So say you take the whole full 60 days to throw your flag, they take 21 days to review it. That's almost half of your time remaining. And if for some reason, hopefully you're successful and the efficiency gets thrown away, but if it doesn't and you're still on the hook to do the new testing or new something, you have to do it within that remaining 100 days, which is relatively short from trying to, you know, if you have to contract tests or get a lab or something, right?
Yeah. I think one of the other things is upfront, before you do your submission, really have that scenario planning done. So you know what's the risk. You know, yep. I like when I do a submission to say, you know, we did a justification here. I think it's likely FDA is going to come back and ask us to do the testing. So you know when that submission goes in, if they come back and ask for this, am I going to do it? Am I going to fight it? Am I going to, right? So I'm prepared so I don't use up that whole 60 days before I decide I'm going to throw the flag or I need to interact or appeal in some way.
That's a really good point.
Yeah. And I think another thing too to think about is to, you know, to manage that timing is to kind of focus on, you know, maybe one or to, you know, the biggest ticket items or the biggest issues. I think both the least burdensome flag and even submission issue requests, you know, it's supposed to be limited to just one or two review areas or expertise areas so that they can, so everyone can kind of focus and get the feedback in that time allotment. So I think really try to focus on, is there one really big issue, and try to get that one resolved, even if maybe you have other questions about the AI letter, but try to focus. And also, you know, make sure that, like Brian was saying, make sure your team is ready to respond quickly, because if you have some kind of 10-day call or a 21-day submission issue meeting, FDA already, you know, the reviewers already have a lot of other submissions on their plate. So if you get feedback or questions from them, they're going to want a response pretty fast in order to help resolve your issues. So making sure that things are planned out and that your team can be ready to respond, I think is really important.
My favorite of all time, though, was FDA recently asked us to submit a submission issue request because their review clock was running out on their 510K. And so they needed the clock to pause in order to hit the MDUFA goals. So that was an interesting first time I've seen that happen. And I'm sure COVID was somewhat related because it's in a therapeutic area affected by COVID. But that's certainly a unique one in my experience.
Did you do it?
Yes, we did it. We thought it was more important to be friends with the reviewer. Mm-hmm. And it goes to that, right? If someone can give me I'm not going to miss this goal, and I think I can get your device clearance, that seems like a better path than starting over if the review clock runs out.
Yeah, I can say I don't think there's any training at FDA like about using that as a tactic for maintaining your clock. So you're very nice to accommodate the reviewer, Nancy, and I'm glad the outcome was in your favor.
Yeah, that's interesting. So you were on hold, you got an AI letter, and then they asked you to submit a submission issue?
We submitted the response to the AI, and they acknowledged that they hadn't reviewed all of the material from the initial submission because they thought it was going to be in a non-substantially equivalent. And the AI response was strong enough that they had to go back and review stuff that they really didn't think they were going to have to review.
Oh, interesting. So they put you back on hold a second time and then actually do a submission issue then? Is that how it
works? They asked us to do the submission issue request in order to put it on hold.
So that is a very unique case study.
Maybe FDA is watching this and they just learned a new tactic. Very interesting. Okay, last question for today, unless anybody has any questions to send in. When should you file a formal appeal versus throw the least burdensome flag? Do you have any like guidance or scenarios to help with that?
Yeah, like Ryan was saying earlier, I think if you're talking about a substantive issue, like something in the administrative file, I guess that's when you go with appeal. You want to work in the nitty gritty. And then if it's more of a like fundamental question about why you're asking this, go towards least burdensome flag. But I guess other things to consider is that least burdensome flag only has fewer applications than an appeal. So an appeal, you can appeal a lot more decisions and for a lot more types of submissions. And then two, something that we've seen is that appeals don't necessarily have to be for something bad, right? We've seen people doesn't have to be something bad or for necessary submission, right? You can appeal a breakthrough decision, for example, or I've seen people approve like approval decisions. So someone's not happy with special controls for a de novo, or someone's not happy with a labeling for a PMA or something, right? And you can appeal those to get a review, right? So if you don't want to delay your approval and you want it, but you're not happy exactly with how it's being approved, you can actually appeal those decisions as well. Because they wouldn't fall under least burdensome, but it's something that people don't necessarily know that you could appeal. So it seems counterintuitive. Why would you appeal something good?
Yeah. And I kind of see the least burdensome flag as being you know, an earlier, a lot earlier in the game as well. So I think it's, you know, least burdensome flag is more, probably more appropriate for resolving issues as they go along in your product development and your, you know, your submission process. Helps you to, you know, if there are any roadblocks along the way, you know, to getting your device to market, you know, trying to resolve those, figure out what needs to be done to get over those roadblocks. You know, that's where the least burdensome flag can be more useful, I think. But also the least burdensome flag, the language that comes in the AI letter talking about the option to use the least burdensome flag, you know, specifically mentions the email address for 510K staff. So I think, you know, the least burdensome flag is really something that would be useful if you want 510K policy staff to get involved or weigh in on it. Because maybe your review team is making a decision about, you know, what might or might not be appropriate as a predicate device, for example. But if you want 510K staff to weigh in and, you know, kind of clarify a certain policy, I think that can be really useful to have a least burdensome flag.
I think that's actually a really good point of bringing in the policy folks in FDA. Because I think while FDA reviewers deal with the submissions all the time, there are sometimes nuances in the regulations of how it's applied, right? And, you know, I know plenty of times I've gone to IDE staff and be like, oh, this is not correct, right? And like, oh, no, actually, in this one line, it's actually okay. And I'm like, oh, great. And I think these policy folks in IDE staff, 510K, PMA staff, who are used to answering like these policy questions rather than like technical in the weeds, nitty gritty stuff, they have a lot more exposure to these kind of questions, like maybe questions that reviewers may not necessarily know off the top of their head.
Yeah, that's actually a great point. I mean, the program staff, PMA staff, ID staff, I mean, they're all just great people and they're sort of emotionally detached from the files as well. They're the regulatory experts for whatever division that they're in. So getting their involvement, especially in a least burdensome type situation, that is a great idea.
Yeah, we had a situation come up this week actually around biocompatibility, and the company had done testing on the worst case scenario, right? The most involved in terms of material. And the reviewer came back and asked them to repeat the testing on the, you know, the other extreme, the least worst case situation. And it's like, that is really different from a policy perspective, right? We've always done worst case scenario and said, gosh, you're testing all the materials, that encompasses everything. And this reviewer's point was, well, no, if you take out this one component and you're left with the other components are now more concentrated, and you really should do this, you know, this other case, even though it's not worst case in terms of exposure. So that's one I think is probably ripe for consideration on the least burdensome, you know, or, you know, as opposed to, because you're not asking, is a 3 okay on cytotox or a 2, you're asking, do I need to do this testing on this sample or not?
It's a good one. Well, thanks, guys. This was such good insight. I am so happy to have former CDRH on our team, especially our new one, Ryan, fresh out of FDA. So thanks for the discussion today. Very helpful.